Our next speaker is a professor of politics and chair of the Peace and Justice Study Program at the University of San Francisco. He serves as Middle East editor of the Foreign Policy in Focus Project and is the author of the book Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, and a recent article from Middle East Policy entitled U.S. Policy Towards Syria and the Triumph of Neoconservatism. It's my pleasure to bring to you Mr. Stephen Zunis, our next speaker.
Thank you. I come to you today as a supporter of Israel in the sense that I believe that Israel has a right to exist in peace and security. I believe that firmly and unconditionally, and for the United States to be a guarantor of that right. And I also come to you as a critic of a number of foreign and domestic policies of various Arab governments, including, with all due respect, the government of Syria. Yet I support this initiative by the Council for the National Interest in putting forward the Israel Accountability Act, because I believe it highlights the need for balance and fairness in U.S. Middle East policy, not just for its own sake, but for the credibility of the United States as a world leader. Because even where concerns the United States has raised regarding the policies of certain Arab governments around such issues as weapons of mass destruction, human rights, UN Security Council resolutions, and other issues, these are immediately delegitimized in the eyes of the Arab world and beyond when we do not apply these same standards towards the state of Israel. And I'd like to illustrate this by highlighting certain key provisions of the Syria Accountability Act and compare them with our certain policies we pursue towards Israel. For example, among the findings in the Syria Accountability Act is Syria's violation of United Nations Security Council Resolution 520, which calls for the strict respect of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, unity, and political independence of Lebanon under the sole and exclusive authority of the government of Lebanon through the Lebanese army throughout Lebanon. Now, but if you actually read the text of UN Security Council Resolution 520, it reveals that the only country mentioned by name is Israel, which had launched a major invasion of Lebanon 3 months prior to the passage of this resolution. At that point, held nearly half the country, including the capital of Beirut, under military occupation. Though the Israelis pulled out of Beirut shortly thereafter and withdrew from most of central Lebanon by the following year, Israel kept its occupation forces in southern Lebanon until May of 2000 in violation of this Security Council resolution and nine other Security Council resolutions calling for Israel's unconditional withdrawal. Now, at the time the UN Security Council Resolution 520 was passed, there were Syrian troops in Lebanon. I think one could certainly make a case, given that Syrian troops remained there, that this resolution could also apply to Syria. But it's interesting to note that none of the supporters of the Syria Accountability Act, to my knowledge, the vast majority of whom were in office during at least some of the nearly 18 years that Israel was in violation of this resolution, ever called on Israel to abide by it, much less call for sanctions against Israel. Indeed, virtually all the backers of this resolution who were in office during this period supported billions of dollars worth of unconditional military and economic aid to Israel despite their violations. Well, and then they turn around and say we need to impose sanctions on Syria for violating the same resolution. I think it's also important to note that there are over 90 UN Security Council resolutions currently being violated by countries other than Syria, the majority of which are being violated by Israel. And again, we see these large-scale American military and economic aid to the government of Israel, as well as to Turkey, Morocco, Indonesia, and a number of others who are currently in, violating the will of the Security Council. So basically, what we found in the Syrian Accountability Act was that the Congress and the President, who signed it, believe that the Security Council resolution should only be acknowledged or enforced in regard to governments the United States doesn't like, but these resolutions should not be enforced or even acknowledged in terms of countries that we do like. And that is not what international law is about. That's not what UN Security Council resolutions are about. And that's what's important about international law, is that there is one single standard. And so when these kind of double standards come out, it undermines not just the search for peace in the Middle East, but the whole credibility of the United Nations system itself. Among the other findings in the Syria Accountability Act is how, quote, even in the face of United Nations certification that acknowledged Israel's full compliance with the UN Security Council Resolution 425, Syria permits attacks by Hezbollah and other militant organizations on Syrian outposts at Sheba Farms under the false guise that it remains Lebanese land and is also permitting attacks on civilian targets in Israel. Sheba Farms, as many of you know, is a disputed piece of land between Syria and Lebanon, but it's not part of Israel. It is under Israeli military occupation, as is much of the Golan Plateau since 1967. And while I personally believe that the occasional attacks by Hezbollah are not helpful in terms of advancing peace in the area, international law is clear that if your country is under foreign military occupation, you have the right to armed resistance. Furthermore, the most recent report by the Secretary General on the situation in Lebanon denounced Israeli violations of Lebanese airspace as provocative and at variance with Israel's otherwise full compliance with Security Council Resolution 425. There have been virtually no border clashes with Hezbollah forces and in Israel since the withdrawal in May 2000. This attack against civilian targets happened to, the only one that I could find, was when Israel, in violation of 425, encroached upon Syrian airspace. Hezbollah fired some anti-aircraft batteries at them, and they came down inside Israel, accidentally injuring three Israeli civilians. Hardly the gross violations that the act implies that it is. Also in regards to Israel, the act calls for the government of Syria to enter serious unconditional, the governments of Lebanon and Syria should enter into serious unconditional bilateral negotiations with the government of Israel in order to realize a full and permanent peace. Now, it's important to, first of all, they insist on bilateral negotiations when UN Security Council Resolution 338 clearly implies the need for multilateral negotiations, particularly given the interrelatedness of the concerns of the three countries. But even putting that aside, it's important to recognize that the Syrian and Lebanese governments have offered full diplomatic relations with Israel and strict security guarantees in return for a total Israeli withdrawal from occupied Syrian territory in accordance with UN Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338. Which successive U.S. administrations have long insisted are the basis for Israeli-Arab peace. However, the U.S.-backed government of Ariel Sharon has categorically rejected an Israeli withdrawal from occupied Syrian territory, even in return for full diplomatic relations and strict security guarantees. Syria has expressed its willingness to resume peace talks with Israel, where the discussions left off in 2000. Israel's right-wing government has refused, however, saying that talks must start from scratch. By insisting that Syria enter the new talks unconditionally, rather than from where the two parties' previous negotiation positions, where both sides made major concessions, which took several years to reach and came very close to success, Congress and the President is effectively rejecting the position of more moderate former Israeli government of Ehud Barak, and instead embracing the rejectionist position of the current right-wing leader, Ariel Sharon. As a result, it's unclear how entering into such negotiations with an occupying power that categorically refuses to withdraw from conquered land would, quote, realize a full and permanent peace, unless the intent was to force complete Syrian capitulation in accepting Israel's annexation of the Golan region. And this would be obviously an unreasonable demand, in part because the UN Charter expressly forbids any nation from expanding its territory by force, and UN Security Council Resolution 497 declares that Israel's 1981 annexation of the Golan is illegal and must be rescinded. I understand that recently Syria has offered, at the very end of last year, to enter negotiations with Israel without conditions. And in response, the Israeli government announced it was doubling the number of settlements in the occupied Golan in direct violation of UN Security Council Resolution 446, 452, and 465, which forbid Israel from transferring its civilian population onto territory seized by military force, as is expressed in the Fourth Geneva Convention. Another part of the Syria Accountability Act talks about the Syria maintaining a number of missiles and rockets, and how these missiles and this whole missile program must be disbanded. Well, what Congress fails to mention is that Israel has a vastly superior missile capability relative to Syria, fielding short-range Jericho 1 and medium-range Jericho 2 missiles, both of which use solid propellant and are nuclear capable. Israel's missiles are significantly more advanced technologically, are more accurate, have a wider range, and can carry larger payloads than the Assyrian missiles. It also comes out talking about how Syria is not a party to the Chemical Weapons Convention or the Biological Weapons Convention. But it does not mention that Israel is not a party to these important arms control conventions either. And basically, you know, again, Congress and the President is saying, well, it's legitimate for Israel and other countries in the region to refuse to ratify these arms control conventions. While it's okay for Israel to have these advanced missiles, Syria does not. And then, of course, we have the provisions of the Act involving Syria's biological and chemical weapons and nuclear research and development. But it's important to recognize that while it's widely acknowledged that Syria, like several other countries in the region, has a chemical weapons program, there is no evidence that Syria currently has any biological weapons. Their nuclear civilian program I'm not sure why it's considered a concern, because of they have accepted the full scope safeguards of the International Atomic Energy Agency to detect diversions of nuclear materials from peaceful activities and the like. But even more crucial than that, I think it's important to point out, is that Israel has by far the largest stockpile of chemical and biological weapons in the region, and it is the only major only nuclear power in the region, having as many as 300 nuclear warheads and sophisticated delivery systems. And while there's no UN Security Council resolution demanding that Syria cease its missile programs or weapons of mass destruction, there is UN Security Council Resolution 487, which calls on Israel to place its nuclear facilities under the trusteeship of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And Israel, of course, is still in violation of this resolution. That does not seem to be a concern of the U.S. government. And it's also important to emphasize that Syria has called for a weapons of mass destruction free zone for the entire Middle East, similar to weapons of mass destruction free zones that already exist in Latin America, South Pacific, and elsewhere. This has been rejected by the government of Israel and by the government of the United States. And my belief is that by imposing strict sanctions on Syria for failing to disarm unilaterally, the U.S. government has rejected any kind of regional law-based arms control regime and has gone on record supporting the idea that the United States has the authority to say which country can have what kind of weapon systems, therefore enforcing a kind of WMD apartheid, which is not only unfair, but is more likely to encourage rather than discourage the proliferation of such dangerous weapons. Anytime you try to impose a regime of haves on have-nots, it'll only make the have-nots more eager to become the haves. And this is simply not going to work. And I think this underlies some very serious problems, which I would say, I realize there may be some people who disagree with me, may even goes beyond simply the pro-Israel lobby. I mean, many of the supporters of this bill were from very, very safe districts and didn't need a dime of money from the pro-Israel PAC groups. I think it's something even worse, and that is that the Congress, including the Democrats, has accepted the neoconservative vision that the United States has this right to act unilaterally, to force some countries to unilaterally disarm while building up others. And what's frightening about the Sierra Accountability Act was that there are only 4 dissenting votes in either house of Congress. It was as close to a unanimous resolution as you could find. Yet I think it would be very hard. I think we'd be lucky if we can find 4 affirmative votes in both houses in support of this of the Israel Accountability Act. And so I think, for me, this goes far beyond the question of Israel and its Arab neighbors to the question of, you know, what kind of leadership does the United States want to take in the world? Because I really think this is going to create far more problems in these crucial areas of international law, arms control, and more if we don't change our position. Because remember, this is not call for a ban on military or economic support for Israel, simply making it conditional. Making it conditional, I think, on very reasonable demands that we are quite willing to put forward to other countries. And, you know, when Israeli friends of mine are involved in the peace movement, hear people say, oh, we can't pressure Israel because Israel's our friend. I think, well, what does a friend do? What do? You see a friend hobbling from a bar, obviously drunk, with the keys in their hand going towards the car. A friend says, no, I will not let you hurt yourself or hurt others. I think that's a fair analogy up to a point, but I'd add to it. We're the bartender. We're pouring the stuff. We're making it possible. And I think we need to support this kind of legislation, not out of a position of being anti-Israel, but from a position of tough love, out of a position of realizing that this is good for all parties concerned, for Israel, for its Arab neighbors, indeed, for the peace and security of the Middle East and the world. Thank you.